Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week, two of the biggest science stories of the year. The first ever British astronaut and the 47-million-year-old fossil that tells us how humans descended from the rest of the animal kingdom. But we've decided to ignore those and instead hop on the train to Hay-on-Wye. Here we've been reading books, listening to lectures and soaking in the sunshine. And we're not alone. Joining us in Wales is the government's economic advisor on climate change, Nicola Stern, and the architect of New Labour, Anthony Giddens, both of whom have lessons for Gordon Brown on the environment.
It does indeed mean paying a bit more for electricity. We'll work out how much. It might be 30 or 40 or 50%. For a while. But at the same time, we'll be investing in energy efficiency, which will bring down the amount of electricity that we consume.
I don't think we're going to get too far by existing strategy, which is essentially based on scaring people. So I think we've got to draw them in. I think we've got to have, as it were, a gestalt switch in policy. I think we need much more positive policy with much more vision of what kind of society we're trying to bring about. We need more of a utopia, less of a dystopia.
Astronomer Royal Martin Rees is on hand to ponder the existence of extraterrestrials and his hopes for space exploration. And biologist Steve Jones gives us his Darwin reading list. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello and welcome to Hay. This sleepy village on the English-Welsh border is consumed by Metropolitan Guardian readers around this time every year, all keen to hear the greatest thinkers of the day debate the biggest issues. Oh, and buy lots of books and drink overpriced wine. This year is no exception. 4 days into the festival that has politics, literature and economics right at the top of the agenda, let's get straight to the thing that has obsessed everyone here right from the beginning, the weather. Fortunately, The Guardian's James Randerson is here to explain what I'm talking about. James?
Well,
What's been different?
It's really quite an unfamiliar experience because it has been gloriously sunny and previous years have been, well, you know, a bit of a mud bath, really.
Absolutely. Last year, I think one of the stages actually nearly sank into the ground. There were fire people pumping water out of the ground during lectures. But actually, unscientifically, that is almost a theme of the festival this year.
Well, yeah, I mean, the general theme of kind of the environment and climate change have been really high up the agenda. I mean, I actually wasn't here last year, so I was particularly struck by the contrast with a couple of years ago where at least my festival, the sort of things that I saw were dominated by the kind of rationalism debate over religion. You had people like, you know, Richard Dawkins here and A.C. Grayling and... Christopher Hitchens railing against the anti-rationalists, and that seems to have sort of died down a bit. And there's been an awful lot about climate change.
There's a memorable event actually where I think Rosie Boycott was interviewing Richard Dawkins about the God delusion. This was the year that came out, and it's a packed crowd of about 1,500 people. The rain was lashing down outside, and just at the point, I think, about 15 minutes into the interview, and Rosie Boycott kind of made him say, you know, that atheism is the way forward and that perhaps believers are, in my words, mental. The thunder at that point outside was quite something. And if that isn't some sort of divine intervention, I don't know what is. But anyway, this year's theme, climate change.
Yeah, and it's not the sort of the stuff we know, you know, the doom and gloom, the science. It's not really about that. It's about the kind of the cultural aspects around it. And for me, you know, it's really interesting because it's sort of taken the debate on from, you know, we know there's a problem, we know things are happening, now we have to work out as a sort of society, as a global society, how we deal with that. And of course, hanging over all of this are the big international climate negotiations in December. And one of the people here, of course, was Nicola Stern, and the Guardian's deputy editor, Ian Katz, interviewed him and began by asking why he's so cheery in the face of all this bad news.
In one respect, there's no alternative, because if we all talk ourselves down and say it's all hopeless, then it will indeed be hopeless. So the only constructive option is to be optimistic. But what we have to do is to set out what's involved and what we can do, how we can do it, what it might cost, what the policies are, and what it would deliver. And what it would deliver is a very attractive form of growth. Low carbon growth is far more attractive, or will be, when we get there, far more attractive than high carbon growth. It'll be cleaner, more energy secure, more biodiverse, probably quieter and safer.
But isn't the truth that we'll have to sacrifice in the short term so that our descendants will have the sunny future that you describe?
We'll have to make investments, and we can identify what kind of investments they're likely to be, and we can work out the kind of costs that will go with those investments. But they're investments, and they're investments in a strong future, and we will see actually ourselves in terms of the different kind of growth, many of those returns. It might cost us 1 or 2% of GDP. That's like a one-off 1 or 2% price increase. That doesn't stop growth, and it actually delivers lots of things to us in the medium term, as well as most profoundly in the longer term, taking down many of these risks.
But in the short term, Nick, shouldn't we be honest and tell people that it means paying more for their electricity, that actually they are going to have to pay bigger bills now to save the planet later?
It does indeed mean paying a bit more for electricity. We'll work out how much. It might be 30 or 40 or 50%. For a while. But at the same time, we'll be investing in energy efficiency, which will bring down the amount of electricity that we consume.
But you wrote a paper a few months ago, Nick, where you said that what was required was an expenditure of around 20% of the economic stimulus that's being paid out to try and rescue us from the financial crisis on alternative energy and other green measures, and that would be a really serious attempt to tackle climate change. And conspicuously, we've seen nothing like that, except from countries like South Korea. Granted, Obama's put a lot of money into it, but nothing like 20%. And in the UK, we are well under 10%. Are you very disappointed about that?
China, which in many ways got the biggest, with the United States, the biggest stimulus package, I think arguably well over 20%. So if you look around the world, we're not far off. That 20% was a very rough rule of thumb, and there are all kinds of issues of classification. But I think that what we're starting to see now in the UK, particularly around this budget, actually, of March, a much more deliberate, strong grappling with the issues. For example, the carbon budgets that were announced along with the budget itself, the decision not to have any more coal-fired power stations without carbon capture and storage.
What about Heathrow, though?
Well, I think the third runway at Heathrow should have been a decision which was taken in the context of a real transport plan. We can't tell whether such a runway is justified with the problems of greenhouse gas emissions unless it's in the context of programs for trains, programs for roads, programs for other airports. And I think that decision was not well taken. My guess is, had it been well taken, it would have gone the other way. But basically, you cannot take a decision like that rationally without looking at the way in which it fits with your overall carbon policies and your overall transport policies. So I don't think the decision was taken in the right way. And my guess is, had it been taken in the right way, it would not come out like that.
That was the former economic advisor to the government, Nicholas Stern, speaking to The Guardian deputy editor Ian Katz about some of the themes in his new book, Blueprint for a Safer Planet. Now, Stern wasn't the only one talking about climate, and in particular, that controversial decision by the government to allow a third runway at Heathrow. The Energy and Climate Change Secretary, Ed Miliband, made an unscheduled appearance to talk to documentary filmmaker and green activist Franny Armstrong. She had some good things to say about Miliband's record, but on flying, they were a long way from agreeing. Here, Franny asks the minister why the government wants to expand airports.
Even after the recession, even after putting a price on carbon, a passenger demand in the UK is expected to double. Now, your position says
95% cut in flights. By
you'd
2020.
Like a 95%
cut. Yeah, yeah. No, the science would not what I'd like. It doesn't matter what I like. If we're going to prevent runaway climate change, which is the goal, then 95% cut in flights, yeah. But I think what you said is absolutely key. Like, it's only one generation ago, that, or perhaps two, that, you know, flying was a magical once-in-a-lifetime experience that you'd look forward to, you know, you'd save up, and you'd go, you know, once a decade. That's what we're talking about. Everybody in this room could fly about once a decade. And then it would be back to being a magical experience. And what's wrong with that? I think we have to look at the level of sacrifice, don't we? Because what we're saying is, you think the British people wouldn't agree to sacrifice their right to go on holiday as many times as they want, fly as many times as they want to. But in order, we're therefore going to ask other people in other countries to sacrifice their lives, i.e. the 150,000 people who are already dying from climate change every year, according to the World Health Organization.
Come on, I'm not saying that.
No, but you are. One follows the other.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we have to achieve the scientific, the cuts in emissions that science demands of us, and that is very important. But I'm saying that flying is the most difficult thing to tackle, partly technologically speaking. I'm saying that the price of airline tickets will go up, including in the United Kingdom. It's part of our emissions trading scheme, which means that there is a price on carbon emissions from aviation for the first time. I'm saying that actually domestic flights will get much less frequent, people will do them much less, and you've got to expand high-speed rail, and you've got to have a big change in relation to public transport. But I am also saying that as someone in the art of persuasion, you know, you have probably 20% of people in this country who are deeply committed on climate change, maybe 40% who are sort of think it's kind of, you know, right to do something but aren't particularly engaged in it, and then a whole group of other people. It, as in the art of persuasion, I'm not convinced that saying to people in my constituency who are able to do things and go to places that their parents could not have dreamed of, that that's all got to end overnight is realistic, which is what you're saying.
Ed Miliband there talking on stage at the Hay Festival with Fanny Armstrong, director of the climate change film Age of Stupid. James, is there a sense that the government is being attacked on more fronts now on climate?
Well, certainly their record is being challenged. I mean, there are some obviously very good things that they've done, like the climate change bill and legally binding cuts year on year in carbon emissions. But, you know, that's a long way from where people like Fanny Armstrong would like them to be. And also, actually, Nicola Stern has started to become, I think, a little bit more militant, which is a difficult word to use with respect to him, I think, because he's so understated most of the time. But I think he really is starting to push the envelope a bit on the sorts of things he's saying in public to try and get the government to do more. But someone else who came out at the Hay Festival with some rather critical words was Anthony Giddens, the sociologist and kind of New Labour thinker, one of the people who's laid the intellectual foundations, I think, for New Labour. He believes that we need a kind of new politics of climate change, and I asked him about that.
Well, I think we need a sort of revolution, actually, in our attitude to the politics of climate change. One of my main arguments is that contesting climate change is a completely unique problem for us. We've never had to cope with a problem like that before, mainly because it's based on abstract future risk, filtered through the findings of science. So no matter how many times, you know, you read that a catastrophe awaits, or catastrophes of various kinds await us, it's hard, I think, for many people to put flesh on that. First of all, there are many other catastrophes around, like swine fever or possible global pandemics or the proliferation of nuclear weapons. I think for many people, pretty difficult to sort out climate change from all those other things. So I don't think we're going to get too far by existing strategy, which is essentially based on scaring people. So I think we've got to draw them in. I think we've got to have, as it were, a gestalt switch in policy. I think we need much more positive policy with much more vision of what kind of society we're trying to bring about. Instead of just talking about costs, although of course there will be costs, a la Stern report, there will be costs, we should also start talking about benefits, opportunities. We should put those to the forefront. Surveys show that people relate much more easily and comfortably to the notion of clean energy. I think we should maximise clean energy investments because they can be a strong instrument of reducing emissions, and look for other strategies which will kind of reverse the traditional emphasis on avoiding a catastrophe. We need more of a utopia, less of a dystopia.
That was the former head of the London School of Economics and architect of New Labour, Anthony Giddens. Now, you might notice the soundscape has subtly changed here. We're in the Guardian's yurt.
Very nice,
A whole load of...
We're lounging, as we say.
We're lounging, apparently, and everyone's with their laptops.
Did you pass me a grape?
only free trade. Organic and free trade, absolutely. No, this is where a whole succession of thinkers and writers have been lounging with various Guardian writers, and one of the people who came along was a very genial Martin Rees. He was here to give two lectures on what our world might look like in 2050, and a second on whether there's life out in space. He dropped into the yurt to tell us his hopes for the future of space exploration.
Well, I think we want to have probes of all our solar system to understand it better. This year has been a good year for advancing our potential understanding of the wider universe with the launch of three important spacecraft. Kepler to look for Earth-like planets around other stars, Herschel to look for stars forming early in the history of the universe in the infrared, and the Planck spacecraft to study the immediate aftermath of the Big Bang, in greater detail than before by looking at the background radiation. So those are all important projects, and two of them are major European projects, which is excellent. Looking further ahead, I think we would like to have further exploration of Mars. We'd like to have a still bigger telescope in space of a kind that might be able to directly image planets and also very, very distant galaxies, a follow-on from the Hubble Space Telescope. But also, I think we can look forward to a new generation of giant ground-based telescopes. And this is an area where Europe can perhaps get a world lead if it continues with plans to build a telescope with a 30 or 40 metre diameter mirror.
One of the tantalising things about those telescopes is that they might be able to image Earth-like planets. Mm-hmm. What are the chances of finding signs of life on those planets?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to lay reliable odds because biology is a harder subject than astronomy, and we don't really understand how life got started on Earth. We understand how from simple life our biosphere has evolved via Darwinian selection processes, but we don't understand how life got started here. And until we understand that, we can't lay firm odds on where it would start elsewhere, nor have any firm view on where best to look for it. But I would hope that we will understand more about the origins of life on Earth within the next 20 years, and that will firm up our views on how likely it is elsewhere. In our solar system, there are places where there could conceivably be some basic forms of life, even on Mars or Europa or Titan, but no one expects anything other than freeze-dried bacteria or something like that anywhere in our solar system. But of course, if one could show that life had started independently elsewhere in our solar system, that would be very important, because if it had evolved twice within one solar system, that would show that it evolved almost everywhere given the right conditions, and at least simple life would be widespread in the universe.
If you're a betting man, would you say that life does exist somewhere in the many multiverses that we might exist in?
Well, I think if we talk about a multiverse, of course, it's a separate story where you have a whole range of physical laws, then certainly life must exist in lots of them. But if we talk about the part of the universe we can observe, I think my betting odds would be that some forms of life would exist. As to whether any intelligent life with an intelligence we could recognise exists, then that, of course, is not anything we've been confident about, but it's such a fascinating question that I'm in favour of searches by all possible techniques.
Astronomer Royal and the President of the Royal Society there, Martin Rees, on whether aliens exist. James, quick question, do aliens exist? You've got 10 seconds.
Yes.
That's it?
Yeah, no.
Where's your working?
It's just a statistical question. You know, with the billions and billions of stars out there, billions of planets around them, you know, there has to be life out there. The only question is it intelligent life, and is it the kind of life that can be asked to get in touch with us?
Such a biologist
we don't
speaking.
Know.
Now, you'll notice the sound has changed again. We're actually sitting next to some strawberries in the sort of Oxfam free trade area of the festival. There's a nice little garden, and we're sitting in a nice couple of deck chairs.
There's lots of people buying things furiously around.
They are, and there's literature whales, all sorts of lovely things going on around here. James, this is very much a books event. Why are we here as people interested in science?
Well, it's much broader than just literature, and that's a conscious decision that the organiser, Peter Florence, has taken. Actually, in introducing Martin Rees's lecture, he gave what was quite a sort of heartfelt, moving tribute to John Maddox, who's a former editor of Nature, former science editor of The Guardian, who died recently. And he said, I forget how long ago, maybe sort of 10, 20 years ago, he sort of took Peter Florence aside and he said, you know, Hay Festival's great, but, you know, you're missing out on some of the best writers in the land who happen to be science writers, and you really should include them. And I think it broadens the festival, it makes it more of a rounded cultural festival about all kinds of ideas, all kinds of big cultural questions. And, you know, people like Martin Rees and Steve Jones just always pack out the tents. I mean, they're perennial favourites here, and, you know, without them it would be really an impoverished event, I think.
I mean, Steve Jones, who we'll hear from in just a while, he packs out the biggest tent here, 1,500 people every year, with, I think, the same lecture.
Yeah, but, basically, yeah.
I'm not sure. Anyway.
I think he freely admits that. A lot of the same gags are there, but I'd love to hear them every time.
My name is Steve Jones. I'm Professor of Genetics at University College London. I don't know what my most important book is this year, but I've just reread, and I hope this is allowed, an enjoyable two books put together, which is Dr. Johnson's Journal of a Tour to the Western Isles of Scotland and Boswell's account of the same event. Now, I read them many years ago, separate books, and they've been put together so you go from one page of Boswell or three or four pages of Boswell to Johnson's take on the same thing. And it's a real joy to read. I strongly recommend it.
Yeah, I'm Tony Giddens, former director of the LSE. My favourite book of the year is David Mackay, Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air, because this is the book which cuts through the hype around renewable technologies, which uses hard-edged science to show just what we can expect from wind power, what we can expect from tidal power, shows that one can't be too ambitious with some of these technologies, is a really useful correction to some of the empty talk that you find in the literature on sustainability.
I'm Marcus Brigstock, and the most important book I've read this year is Fixing Climate by Wally Brocker and Robert Kunzig. And I was given the book at last year's Hay Festival, and I saw Wally Brocker speak. And he is he's an expert on climate history, and that seems to be an excellent way to work out what might happen next, is to look at what happened or what has happened before. And that book is great because it's full of really interesting stuff, some funny stuff, and also at the end full of hope that it's not, you know, this isn't the end of mankind and the end of the planet and all the rest of it. You know, these are solvable problems.
You heard the biologist Steve Jones there, among others, talking about his most important book from the year. Jones is also the resident rock star scientist here at Hay, and once again he packed out the biggest tent to deliver a lecture on his favourite subject, Charles Darwin. His latest book, Darwin's Island, is all about the great scientist's body of literature, the millions of words he published in Books and Letters. Before the lecture, I asked him to give Science Weekly listeners a guide to some of Darwin's less famous books. If you've managed On the Origin of Species, I said, what should you pick up next?
I'd say without question the first one would be The Voyage of the Beagle, which stands not only as a work of science, not only as a work of adventure and a work of travel, but as a work of literature in a way that almost none of the others do. I mean, they're well written, but The Origin is, I often think, the best travel book ever written. And I say that having read many, many travel books, because it was a journey with a purpose. A journey without a purpose is just tourism. You know, if you read modern travel books, you have the smell of the publisher's advance around them. You know, why am I bothering to read this story? Why is he doing that? Darwin is not like that. Darwin knew that he was transforming the world of science at the age of 22, and there are not many books that are built around that. So that would be the first one I'd read. I then actually then go to his very last book, which is about earthworms. And that, too, summarizes his views, because Darwin's a great believer in what he called the transformative power of the small. And people mocked him for being interested in earthworms. Who could possibly care about the actions of this pathetic little creature? Indeed, in Darwin's day, they were thought to be garden pests. People used to try and get rid of them. They used to pour boiling water down their burrows because they thought they were destroying the soil. They weren't destroying the soil. They were making the soil. And by making the soil, they were founding farming. They're allowing farming to happen. And by allowing farming to happen, they allowed civilization to develop. And Darwin saw that, and Darwin makes that clear. He asked questions, obvious questions. Why do we have to dig to find archaeological remains? Why aren't they just sitting there on the surface, waiting for us? It's because the earthworms have buried them. And if they buried the fallen swords and the fallen belt buckles, they buried everything else as well. So he went to Roman ruins and found out, indeed, the earthworms had buried them. So that, too, is a kind of transformative book. And then I go right back to the beginning, his first scientific book after The Voyage of the Beagle, which is his Coral Reefs work. And that, I think, showed the mind of a young genius, because the puzzle of the coral reefs, until Darwin wrote his book, was very, very deep. Nobody could understand them. An atoll is out in the ocean, springs up from the bottom of the sea, thousands of feet down, where it's pitch black. It's made by living animals, polyps, that can only live in the top 20 or 30 or 40 feet where there's light. So how could this possibly happen? Darwin worked it out before he ever saw a coral atoll. He saw that in South America there were reefs that had been lifted away from the sea. And he thought, that means that the surface of the earth is plastic. So what must happen is that there's a volcano, comes out of the sea and slowly sinks back. First of all, the corals make a fringing reef around it. The volcano sinks further and further until the volcano disappears and the coral atoll is left. And not until 1946, when the Americans did a huge drill into Bikini Atoll because they want to blow it up with a hydrogen bomb, not until then was it proved that his idea was right. And that's pretty impressive, to be right 120 years before your time.
Now, Darwin wrote millions of words. Did he enjoy the writing process?
I think he says he didn't, but I can't imagine he would have written as much if that were true. I think a lot of his books are rather technical, and they're his laboratory notebooks, really. And I think there he wasn't concerned about enjoying. He was just giving an account of what he'd done. And a lot of his plant books, many of which are extraordinarily detailed, and I have to say in parts extraordinarily boring, are a bit like that. But he could certainly write, and I think he knew he could write. He decried his own prose style now and again, but that wasn't fair. His last work, which is not supposed to be published, but was, which is his autobiography, which he'd written for perusal by his family, is a little gem. You know, it's written by somebody who knows he can write. It's very touching. And I think he certainly could write. And he could write, probably, not because he was a scientist, because he trained as a classicist. You know, he could speak Latin and Greek, and that helps.
And how does his work sit in the sort of history of British literature?
Darwin's work sits oddly in the history of British literature because it's much more important to British literary theory, in some ways, than it is... I shouldn't say this about my own subject, than it is to the science of biology. Because, of course, if Darwin hadn't done what he did, somebody else would have done it. And, in fact, Wallace almost did. But when you get to people like George Eliot and so on, who took so much from Darwin, and indeed many others, H.G. Wells was a passionate Darwinian. He did a lot to form English literature. So the book itself, The Origin of Species, changed English literature in a way that it didn't change science, because the science is there waiting to be discovered. The book is there as a monument of human effort. So I think you have to separate the two. I'm not decrying Darwin's biological work, which is absolutely astounding, but the work was there, and if he hadn't done it, somebody probably not called Jones, but possibly called Wallace, would have done it. That isn't true of the thing as considered as a work of literature.
Pod favourite Steve Jones there. The Guardian's daily podcast from Hay will also feature a discussion of Darwin's literary achievements later in the week. Go to guardian.co.uk/hay for that. James, Darwin, it's Darwin year. It'd be strange if there weren't lots of Darwin events. What else is there around?
Well, he's very much in evidence here. Steve Jones, of course, giving his lecture about that, but also Gillian Beer was here talking about what we can tell about the man from his writings, and also the poet Ruth Pardle, who is Darwin's great-great-granddaughter, is scheduled to be here this week, but there's some controversy at the moment over whether she'll come or not. But anyway, there's lots of different ways of looking at Darwin this year, which is, I think, quite appropriate.
Actually, Steve Jones's book, Darwin's Island, he said in his lecture was, he's based his entire career on plagiarising Darwin bit by bit. Every book that Darwin wrote, he's written a version of himself. So
yeah, because Almost Like a Whale is on the Origin of Species, isn't
it? With modern stuff. He does himself down slightly, but...
quite a lot, actually, yeah.
But anyway, he said that Darwin's Island for him was an attempt to not have to write all of Darwin's other books, because there's scores of them. There's books on barnacles.
Yeah, I was going to say, the one on barnacles would be a bit of a slow read, even with Steve Jones writing it, I suspect.
For more information on Darwin, of course, and the bicentenary, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science/Darwin. Well, that's almost it for this special Hay Festival edition of Science Weekly. Before we go, though, a word from the comedian Marcus Brigstock. Picking up on this year's unofficial festival theme, he thinks we all need a bit more of an inspirational climate change message.
You know, the doom-laden statistics are out there now. We know. Everybody knows. And most people get it. I think what people are looking for now is something to aspire to, something positive. And I ended up after the session last night talking to people about the idea Martin Luther King didn't have a nightmare, he had a dream, and he gave people something to aspire to. And actually, the rhetoric of fear, the language of fear, is so overused at the moment in terms of everything, terrorism, politics and climate change, and actually we need some things to aspire to.
It's interesting what you say, because I was talking to Anthony Giddens. He was saying very much the same thing. His new book is about exactly that, that we need a kind of new politics, we need a sort of positive vision, yeah, rather than a scary vision. How do we actually go about doing that, and is it going to take someone quite special to provide that?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. It's definitely going to take someone special. I mean, I was just talking to someone just before about, you know, William Wilberforce convinced a lot of people to do something that was against their own best interests because he knew it was the right thing to do and it had to be done. And, climate change needs, collectively, we need to create a sort of an echo of what Wilberforce was able to do, to use great rhetoric to explain to people, look, on we go now. Let's move on to something that's altogether better.
Is there a kind of comedy of climate change developing, or is this the sort of subject that goes down like a lead balloon?
Yes to both of those questions, or those proposals. Yeah, there is a comedy around climate change, and yes, it can go down like a lead balloon. The reason it goes down like a lead balloon is whoever you're talking to, be it someone who doesn't think it's happening at all, they're nutters, so they won't get it. Someone who does think it's happening, but it's not our fault, well, they'll be annoyed, because I do think it's a lot to do with us. Or people who do think it's our fault and it's happening, they usually feel bad because they're not quite doing enough. So like everybody feels a bit bad about climate change, and it's quite hard to get beyond that.
That was the comedian Marcus Brigstocke on climate change. James, the idea of how we campaign about climate change, just winding up the theme from the beginning of the podcast, is quite interesting, because the science is settled, and everyone here is now talking about the sociology and the politics and the economics of it. Stuff that Martin Rees, in both of his lectures, said is far more complicated than the science of climate change, actually, and we may or may not be able to deal with properly. Ed Miliband says that we need some sort of make poverty history type campaign. Would that sort of thing work? Are we sort of trying to find a way to campaign about this now?
I think there is a real effort at the moment to try and find a political message that gets through not just to those who are committed on this issue, but, you know, to the vast majority of people, which frankly is what you need if you're going to put through the sort of political measures that the scientists say are necessary. So there is a real difficulty here, and I don't think people have really found it yet. I mean, it's interesting, because you have someone like Franny who really deploys the kind of scare people message. You know, she says we really have to cut our flying by 95%, because otherwise, well, even at the moment, 150,000 people are dying a year due to climate change, and that number is going to skyrocket. So that's the kind of classic scare people into action message. But then you have Giddens saying that just won't work for 80% of the population, and you need to kind of paint a vision of a beautiful, aspirational, inspirational future for them that we should all be able to aspire to, and that the sort of short-term pain is worth it to get there.
Well, that's exactly the message that Giddens and Stern have both been saying. Stern, with his measured militancy, as you said earlier, is very cheerful about the opportunities for clean technology investment and bringing ourselves out of a recession, using climate change as a reason. And also Anthony Giddens, of course, who's quite critical of his own sort of party, New Labour, saying that they've not really grasped the nettle on this. But what I thought was interesting about him was, before the lecture, I didn't want to like what he was about to say. I thought, why are you getting involved? Who are you? You don't know anything about this. But he made quite an interesting point. He said that amongst my friends, who are mostly professors and very educated people with degrees, he said that most people think that climate change doesn't exist. They're all sceptics, which shocked him. It shocked me.
Pretty scary, isn't it?
So there's clearly a lot of persuasion that we have to still do.
Okay. I think we need a comedy of climate change.
We need a comedy of climate change.
Yeah.
Marcus Brigstocke's the man.
Do you know any climate change gags?
You're quite comedic. You should get up there.
I heard a climate change gag this week. I don't know if you reckon it's any good. Two planets floating around in space, sort of ties in with Martin Rees, kind of. And one says to the other, "I'm really under the weather. Feel really I've got really itchy and I've got a bit of a temperature and I just feel really bad. And the other one says, oh, right, oh, so that's really bad. That sounds like a classic case of Homo sapiens. You know, really, really? Is that serious? He says, oh, no, don't worry. It'll go away soon enough.
You can laugh yourself. You need to work on some more material. James, thank you. Thanks to you and to all the guests who joined me and him in the Guardian Yurt. Thanks also to the weather for giving us all something to talk about this weekend. Remember, you can keep up to date with the rest of the Hay Festival with the Guardian's daily Haycast. Go to guardian.co.uk/hay. The rest of the science and environment news, of course, is on our website, guardian.co.uk/science/environment. Next week, we'll be back with our regular programme and we'll go into forensic detail on fossil Eda and discuss whether it was more hype than substance. We'll also celebrate our new British astronaut, so please do join us for that. Until then, I'm Alok Char. The programme was produced by Francesca Panetta and Scott Corley. Thank you all for listening.